Welcome back to the Six of Swords. This is Six of Swords, episode 2. We have Ebra with us this evening. That's the name for Evan. Evan is a great guy. I met him through our Invisibles reading group, of which I will say no more, except for the fact that it's a little bit relevant that one of the main characters in the Invisibles, a psychopomp, it's Tom O'Bedlam. And there's a really great foray into what that goes into for Evan himself, but we're not going to touch on that in this episode. We're not going to talk about Judy. We'll probably bring that up another time, but for this evening, suffice to say, we're going to leave all of the Invisible stuff where it belongs, and that's... In this podcast, we're going to be talking about a lot of different stuff, but... I don't think you really know what we're going to be talking about yet, so I really encourage you to dive right on in, and other such things. So I want to say thank you so much for the encouragement, and also this is the part in the show where those who have donated $200 and above for the executive level get to have their names and messages read. It's value for value. If you love the show, donate to the show, occultfan@gmail.com when you're at PayPal, or you go to www.occultfan.com and you'll hit the donate button. You'll also go to /WOH in the future. But for now, let us away into the show. And away we do go. Hey there, welcome back to the Six of Swords. This is Six of Swords Season 2. And this is Six of Swords 2, so that's just basically Six of Swords 2, but there's two twos, because you know how we do. It's a Twin Peaks kind of thing going on over here. Mirror worlding right through with us for this very special 39th overall-ish, but who's counting? 2-2 episode, the Six of Swords episode 2. We have Evan, or Ebra O'Bedlam. Evan Walker is an occultist, a paranormal enthusiast, an aspiring psychoquester. Watch him get terribly lost in all the unanswerable mysteries of the universe. Evan, hey man, what's going on?
Hey, not much. How are you doing?
Great-ish, great. Welcome to the Six of Swords.
Glad you're having me.
It is a mutually reciprocal thing, man, so it's all gravy. Do you know the original cover of Wish You Were Here, the album cover that has like a picture of two gentlemen shaking hands, and then there's like one of them getting burned by the other one, like that?
Yeah, that's classic. Lots of t-shirts.
Have you ever seen on the side of it, on the upper right-hand corner, how actually in the graphic itself, it burns off the corner of the page a bit?
Like a film catching fire type of thing?
It basically, yeah, it just reveals a bit more of the scene because it's burned away the frame around it. So it says something within itself, I think.
Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at that in a long time, but I'm going to go look at it again.
1975, just for, you know, because for those keeping score at home, that is the year that was released. And of course, Syd Barrett, who is referenced heavily in a Jane Lynch episode of The X-Files. So Jane Lynch episode had this guy that was like a kind of insect kid, and she was an insect. She was like, "You'll never be like the other kids," you know. And it had like Jesse from Breaking Bad in it, Aaron Scott, and
Paul
Scott. Thank you. I was like, Paul Scott. And it was long story short, this kid was obsessed with Syd Barrett, and it's like, "You'll never be like the," you know. So. Mm-hmm. Anyways, needless to say, the Pink Floyd reference running through things is actually something that we're going to return around to again and again. But do you want to start us off on something that almost doesn't seem Pink Floyd related, but we'll see how many degrees of it takes us to get there. Talk about something that you brought up recently that I feel that is no... accident. These things happen, you know, you get them through a moment of crisis or something. So let's talk about Zelda and how that connects to Pink Floyd.
I have no idea how Zelda connects to Pink Floyd.
Yeah, let's figure it. Let's find that way. Let's start doing that.
Wish I
bet there's listeners out there like already done it, but like let's find a different way.
Yeah, I'm trying to
What's the first thing that you want to start off with? No, start talking about Zelda. So, like, what's up? No, we meander there. No, there's no pressure here. We see when it happens, not because.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Because I think we were talking about before.
What's your favorite Zelda?
I'm going to go with Ocarina of Time, then Link's Awakening.
Then Link's Awakening. What if I told you I had to hand an actual ocarina proper?
I'd be impressed.
Oh, that's what I'm playing right there. Yeah. Proper ocarina. Mm-hmm. It sounds a little bit like a recorder on a certain in the morning. Ah, sweet. Anyways, I'm not going to turn this into like an ocarina concert, but like, yeah, they're really pretty. Yeah, sweet. Anyways, that's enough of that. So that's an ocarina. Why is that your favorite one?
Well, you know, technically Link's Awakening was my first one.
First go with favorite, then go first. Right? What? Anyways, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So first was Link's Awakening.
What's your favorite? What's your
Ocarina of Time is my favorite.
And why?
It's real close between those two, though.
But why is it your favorite?
I think I just have to look at the aggregate influence on everything else. And then, you know, Majora's Mask kind of, those three all came out together. There was just something about that time period and in those games and sort of how it informed a lot of things in my future. I can still remember my mother going like, you know, why do you keep on drawing that frowning guy with the sword over and over and over again? And I think a lot of elements of that, just how the storytelling worked and everything, and kind of later influenced how my brain developed into becoming a magician and getting into occultism and everything else.
I like the connection you make there.
Yeah, so I don't think I get that without Zelda. I don't think I get my love of myth, my love of fantasy. All that stuff all stems from my friend Jerry. I remember the kid, you know, just talking about this game, and I had him played. And the mental description was I had before, in these sort of like very stark, very, very Jungian kind of images that came to mind as he described this thing. And then I got it for Christmas. You know, even my dad played it. He never played a video game. So everything kind of wraps around that.
Yeah, I hear you, man. I feel that. That's nice.
Even some of my earlier like big dreams, you know, the big dreams, like the things that kind of inform, like number one after Majora's Mask, I was with my cousin, my brother on this like land bridge across this giant lake, and there was this big floating whale that kind of looked like the whale off the Leviathan Mastodon album. Years later. So that's one of those things you think back on, because I've done that a few times over the years, going like, why the hell do I do that thing, or where the hell did that come from?
Does the ideas have us? Do we have the ideas? Like, you know, Jung would say too, it's the same. It's like, it almost like, to me, I'm looking for the same thing you are in this, you know, because what is Zelda in a way? It's that kind of Grail-esque thing. But, you know, the before we even say the G word, right, you know, I have to understand that, like, not everything is reducible to this. It's not an overarching thing, and it's just like, if you happen to be on that one, if that's your trip, take it, kind of thing. You know, it's like, before we go too far into the disclaimer hood, that's all we need to say, really. So, like, yeah, I think there's something about Zelda in itself that, at least at its heart, because we have to like look at what it came from, like its origins do matter in that way, because it's like, what were its intentions? And, you know, it also matters what happens because of what was said, but still, you know, originally it had a lot to do with going into that underground, fighting the beast, you know, collecting the parts of yourself, reconvening your full consciousness for your capabilities to be activated so that you can actually maybe transcend to the next dimension of game. I don't know. But what do you say about your first one? What's there to say about the that, because that ocarina is actually in that first one. That's a Twin Peaks game too, because it was actually inspired by Twin Peaks.
Yeah. So Link's Awakening, and they kind of did, and I don't know if they do with all the Zelda games, but there was kind of this theme where you had a main game, like, and so that would be Link to the Past before that one. And then you have this like existential crisis game that, like, you know, definitely would kind of shake you. Because I remember being a little, even nowadays, like, I think about being a little shaken by the end of
No good game doesn't, no good game does like leaves you like fully intact by the time you're done with it. Like, I agree with you. There has to be some, I would say, in a large amount of thing in cases, the general property is that it has to have some kind of like emotionally jarring, shaking effect in changing you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
That's for it to be a good game. Carrie.
Yeah. So, but you know, mild spoilers, you know, when you wake the wind, well, not mild ones, big one, but the game's been out for a long time.
Good play. I hope you've listened to my song since last night, by the way. Joking, inside joke. Keep going. Don't worry about it. Keep going. Yeah. So what happens when you wake the wind, fish, Evan?
The island disappears.
Boom. Yep. Crash.
Yep. And so that's kind of a, you know, playing that game as a kid, you kind of walk away from that game going like, what did I just do? Did I just kill all these friends I just made? Are they gone?
I know. It's haunting. It's defying reality.
Yep. And then you get kind of a similar thing with Majora's Mask, even though I think that one is the horror's more on Link in particular. I think with Majora's Mask. I need to replay. I haven't played it
Tell
in a while.
Tell that to the butler's son. Yeah.
Tell that to the butler's son.
At the very opening of the game, when you're heading through after you've been transformed into the Deku Kid, Deku Scrub, you end up going through this hopping around these platforms before you reach the tower where you can access the traveling mask salesman. Right before you access the traveling mask salesman, as if just one step outside of the magic of Clock Town, this little creature, this tree guy, is gnarled into place, and he looks, as the game L-targeting information access button will tell you on that screen, it says, look at him, he looks so sad. I could almost cry looking at him, or something to that effect. And it begins the game pretty much off on that sad tenor. And you see this very miserable-looking little tree stump guy. And it's almost like the doppelganger stuck in negative time of your character's predicament. And instead of going into Clock Town, he's frozen right after stepping out. So in the meanwhile, all I'm saying is that you go in there and you meet the Happy Mask Salesman, yada, yada. You end up going to your first in the South Swamp. You end up meeting the king of the Dekus, or Dekus, whatever, right? Potato Patoopadoo. And you to Potato Toupee. And you see that, long story short, that's actually the butler of the king's nephew, or son, excuse me, his son. And he talks about when you race him to get the pig mask, that he says, you remind me of when I was racing my son. And so that's
right.
That is.
Yep, because that's right, because you need to take a soul to get the masks to work. I remember hearing that somewhere. I think this whole idea where there's the masks are inspirited by something else. And so
it seems like that's the reasonable thing to take, you know, so maybe you're wearing the Deku mask of his son, basically.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that now. Yep. The whole thing's.
Well, it just makes sense, you know, and it adds to like why that's there. Exactly.
Yeah, so that was kind of a theme with those four Zelda games kind of back-to-back. You had the main adventure, which, you know, had its bittersweet melancholy moments and its moments of fear and heroism. But then the
dude, you burn down that guy's house and he gives you a heart or medicine. He's like, dude, don't kill me. Just take my heart. That first game's extremely dark. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Friends with monsters underground. He's like, hey, don't tell anyone.
That's right. We're talking about Link's...
Links, like, that could have been like a metaphor for like an underground, like, yeah, I'm just talking about Legend of Zelda 1985, 86, Zelda 1 proper, NES.
Oh, yeah.
You burn down a bush and you go under there and there's a moblin and there's like Tilno, and it's like he bribes you to live.
Well, that's post-apocalypse. That's the end of the world right there within the Zelda timeline, I think. I don't know if the new one's later than that or not, but there is a rough kind of
timeline. Yeah, I got that Hyrule Historia over there. You can look at that online.
Yeah, I'm just
it's not really something I ascribe to. I cast that aside. I treat each one as a game. That's not the end of any timeline to anything. It's just a game. It's just a singular game that exists in a singular time. It's just 1985. It doesn't even exist anymore. Backwards time. See my point? So the idea is that backwards time is a similar concept to what you get when you use Majora's Mask. It's just like, all right, the world's gone to shit. all you can do is start over. Basic premise is until you get it right, everything's going to die. And if you don't do anything, it could end forever.
Yeah. And I like your decolonized view of the timeline.
We might find ourselves in right now, possibly. Go on. What were you saying?
Oh, I like your decolonized view of the timeline.
LOL.
Yeah. Like it.
I'm just saying that it's a fuck. It's more like art purity or nerdishness to an OCD inappropriate level. It's just a joke halfway because, you know, the people who write it write the canon, you know, and if the fans wrote a better one, they could write a better one and it might like reorganize this one into some way that the next game that comes out is based upon that. You see how it feeds and it's like a triangular thing because there's the pure creativity and the extant creature that's born. There's the fan base. And then there's the people who are allowed by, providence, really. You think about it, it's like, oh, it could be anyone making news. No, there's like, 24 hours in a day, 7 days in a day. So there's a certain amount of people who are going to have access to that by virtue of just where they're at in fortune's wheel. And these people who get to make these games are very unique and lucky. And we can actually probably go back through their names and like the people who did the music for the forest in the Raccoon Forest. You know, you find that American translator music guy's name and like see what it gematrifies to and anagrams to. And there's a magic spell. You know, that's how you cast a prayer for higher love to permeate through the entire world by people having video game parties, like doing some weird spells, right? So then you go into the forest, you take mushrooms, and you hop around like Mario while chanting that name backwards or something. There you go. Bob's your uncle. Plum Bob, there you go. If you want to go further with that connection, Final Fantasy Universe is even better. How familiar are you with those games?
Oh, so I'm actually replaying Final Fantasy VII right now. I decided.
Good. That's timely. Talk about it a bit.
Yeah. I'm just now in the Shinra Corp.
I was just about to say I was looking up some Shinra wallets online last night. I love that fucking chess pieces yesterday, dude. Shinra wallets. Let's keep going.
Yeah. So I'm just now in the.
You understand what I'm saying? Like I looked up online like last night, like a Shinra like business card holder or something like that on eBay, some shit like that.
Yeah. Have you been? Was that just a flight of fancy?
I believe it was.
Playing? Okay.
No. It was just kind of something that it's neat. By the way, if you I'm not saying that like you're mine and Dave's love child, but if you took Nate and Dave's name, you get Evan. Like Nate and Dave, it's weird. NAVE. Anyways, just noticed that. Didn't mean to spring that on you. Sorry, Dave. I'll see about the alimony. I think Evan's old enough to be on his own now, though. All right. So anyways, roundabout point, you're playing Final Fantasy VII, which starts off with Cloud and a train car. So there's this underground train car you start off as a... Tell us the background, because I think some people who are listening are not going to be familiar with the whole thing. And you have to start off with a specific Final Fantasy if you're talking about it. You're not going to be able to talk about 8, talking about 7. So maybe give us a little primer. Especially since you're fresh into it.
Yeah. So 7 starts off kind of right in the middle of this terrorist mission to blow up this magic juju reactor in this city called Midgar.
Go slow with the story too, like build up to this crazy shit because it gets wacky.
Yeah. And again, I'm just now re-entering a world I have not set foot in 20 years. So
we know that magical realism matters and that you're actually doing something cool. I will just say this right now out of the left field, if you will. But like, I think you're doing something good for us by playing this game and actively playing it and enjoying it and thriving in it. I think you're doing something for us. I really do. I don't know what, but carry on.
Yeah, so I'd say the first 30 minutes of Final Fantasy VII hold up really, really, really well. It is incredible how well that still holds up. The graphics have not aged as well as some other games. They're re-releasing it, I think, next month, which is why I was wanting to replay it. So, you know, but I'm going to get back on track with the story.
Are they really going to, or is this just like the Brexit of video games? We'll see.
This is not Duke Nukem Forever. That did come out, though.
We're just going to treat that game like Voldemort, the game that shall not be named.
Yeah, no. So the city is a Midgar, which is run by this corrupt corporation called Shinra. I've forgotten exactly all the the little nitpicky stuff about Mako, but it is like, you know, your life mana energy that comes from the world. And it is this big city with these, I think, is it 8 or 12 nodes around it?
Yeah, I believe it's eight.
Yeah, so it's eight. And I think that, and it kind of goes with that nine cosmology, the nine worlds. Midgard seems to have a somewhat appropriative Viking motif.
Forget appropriative. Like, don't worry about that. Yeah. Like, this is just what they do. If you're looking at Final Fantasy VIII with those kind of lenses, you'd be shitting your pants. So here's the point. They got the huge ass snake right there, the Midgar serpent, right? The life serpent, like the Nordic serpent right there. Like, there's, yeah, totally on that. But keep going.
Yeah. And so you're playing Cloud Strife, who is a former mercenary. Kind of joined up with the corporate, the Shinra Corporation's elite soldier group, police force type thing. He has left that and has gone back and is just doing this job for the money, helping out these renegades called Avalanche, who are plotting to blow up this reactor. And you go in there with this guy with a gun for an arm named Barrett, Biggs, Wedge, or a couple of your teammates, Star Wars reference.
Which in Final Fantasy 12, they go by Duigs and Gibbs, by the way, just FYI. And eight, they're an inept pair of soldiers for the bad guys. Anyways, go ahead.
Yep, common motif that goes through there. But I think was it Julia is the other one? Was that other character's name? I'm trying to remember the Avalanche members.
Tifa?
No. Tifa's not in there yet. There was another, the one that keeps falling and you got to help him out. I think it's Julie or something like that. I can't remember.
I can't remember, dude.
Yeah, I just played it, but it's
kind
of, you know, forgettable character. So
keep going. Yeah.
You know, you go in.
Go on.
Yeah. You know, you go in, immediately things go, you know, go to hell in a handbasket. You get, you know, giant spider robots being called on you. And you go and you blow up this reactor and you escape. And then end up going back to the Sector 7 slums where Cloud and everybody else is from, and there you meet back with Tifa, who's his childhood friend who got him roped into this entire thing. But then immediately you see, like, and this is kind of the part I don't remember as a kid, the blowing up the reactor apparently killed like millions of people. And so, and I just didn't remember that as a kid, but I'm just like, I just committed an act of true, like did the ends really justify this means? I know I'm trying to, you know, save the Earth because they're draining the Earth of its Mako. Was this, you know, sacrifice worth it? But yeah, and that kind of completes the first.
Think of what happened to Japan.
Yeah. So I can. Ooh, I wasn't even thinking about the overall cultural perspective on that. Again, it's been 20 years, but yeah, that and that kind of completes that first little act, and that stuff holds up super well. The music's spot on. There's something about the ambiance. There, even just kind of moving your way through the slums and stuff after you complete the mission with all the rest of these little pixel people, you know, kind of checking their corners and everything. There's just something about the
little mining town down there, getting to know the bartender and learning your weird stuff from that hopping question mark thing icon that's like in a bunch of crates behind a locked fence. Yeah, to the detail, brother. I remember that. And then I ended up stopping playing about right around there. Right before getting really into the Shinra, because you're about to get into that, I ended up I bought all three, Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 9, the greatest hits, right when they had the PS1, and I was like 17 or something. I went in to play them, began that one. I got up to that jumping question mark, was like, what the fuck? Fuck this game. And I wasn't feeling it, and I threw in 8, and you know who I am now, a cult fan, and that's in Final Fantasy 8. So, you know, the legend is there. But here, back to you. It is true that there's a whole thing where then they get attacked, right? Now soldiers get sent into that town or something. What happens next?
Yep. You actually go and you get a second reactor because it's all like almost happening. And that's what's really neat about the, it's almost like an action game more so than it is your traditional RPG for that first act of the game. Because it's this sort of it's a linear narrative, but it's done very well.
Sure.
And so, you know, you wake up the next day after blowing up the first one. Tifa goes along with you with Barrett. You go. And then the next mission goes horribly. It goes really wrong as they're expecting you. You manage to get to the reactor, but end up falling off a bridge when this helicopter attacks. Or spider, I can't remember. And you fall off the bridge, and then you end up...
It explodes.
Yeah. And you fall into this old church where this gal named Aerith is planting some flowers. And
this game really hits all the points, but keep going.
Yeah. And so Aerith, nurses you back to health over a short time. Somehow Cloud survives. It's like, you know, probably a good 500-foot fall, if not more.
The music in that slum underground village where you have to end up dressing in like bikinis and stuff like that. You know?
Oh, they're kind of reggae.
Thing. Oh man, I could never get tired. You know, it sounds like either like you'd never get tired of it, or that's the music they play in hell. I don't know, one or the other.
Yep, no, and that bass line, and it's the music. What makes it? It's the melodrama, and I love melodrama.
It reminds me of Galbadia in Final Fantasy VIII with the funky like clavichord bass line, like old funk style.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Like
Hip City. Yeah, man, Hip City.
Yeah, and the music what makes it, because you do have these, and it's simplistic art, but these backdrops and the way these images work together and the way this medium works, it is not photorealistic. These are, you know,
sure,
even for 1997, not great character models, but
you're correct on that. And it goes like the Rankin Bass Hobbits weren't the best animation, but like that, there's a world there.
Yeah, the Ralph Bashy stuff too.
Anyone like that. Then you could go R. Crumb or, Harvey P. Carr if you wanted to go, you know, or you could go for the whole comic book thing with Kirby and then Stanley. And I don't know, like that's a whole other left medium. And you could go to the right with like, you know, people who do Stan Brackage for film, or someone like, you know, Jodorowsky or something like that. So anyways, back to the Dali, and if not, you know, Bosch, back to the show. So what were we gonna hop onto about Seven? Now you got the second botched attempt, you fall through, you got errors, now we're in the slum village where you can dress, where you can cross dress, because you know it wouldn't be a game.
Yeah, there's actually I kind of want to talk. There's kind of maybe a Twin Peaks reference in there a little bit, almost a very Twin Peaks scene.
Well, David Lynch does the whole thing with David Duchovny. You know, you got DLDD, and David's like, he's actually, yeah. Anyways, so well, yeah, let, go on.
Well, let me get to this part.
Yes, go.
So Aerith, this dude named like, his name's like, it's almost Johnny Reno. I think the name is just Reno. He goes in there and he's trying to recruit Aerith because she's special into the Shinra Corporation.
Right.
You go through this whole thing where I botched terribly, where you're supposed to like throw barrels down on top of these guys, and
yes,
ended up just kind of like not doing too well, but got through that progress. And
it's like Olivia in Fringe, though. She's, you know, a very powerful. It's that story.
Yeah.
Go on. Yeah. So you got the men in black. Reno's a men in black trying to recruit her for the dark purposes, but she's a white lodge magician. Go on.
Yeah, and the cleric, healer.
Well, you repeat yourself.
Yes. Getting my train of thought. So you go and you
barrels. You fucked it up. You're supposed to drop them down and it like manipulates them later. You're walking on these beams and, you know, it's difficult to do in the moment. It's really, you know.
Yeah, because I couldn't remember. I remember doing it before, but I'm like, okay, what was the secret here?
So what happens next? Let's get this caught up so we can, because this is timely, because there is the game allegedly coming out. Maybe it'll happen this time.
Maybe. So. I think it will. So after you get away from those guys, you wonder, you kind of start escorting Aerith because she's not going to let you go alone, and she doesn't want you to be by yourself. And you end up noticing Tifa, Cloud's childhood friend and perhaps sweetheart, depending how you play things, on this very elaborate carriage, dressed in hot pants, I guess, as much as they can illustrate in the game, heading towards the wall to Walmart area. And you go and follow it and figure out that she's trying to gain the company of Don Corneo. There we go. Who is a local, you know, slum baron who likes the company of beautiful women, and they bring him three every night, and he tries to pick one, and bad things happen. There's a lot of dark stuff going on there. They kind of skirt around, but he's definitely not a good dude. So. You don't know why.
So you don't feel bad for breaking in there. It's like morally gray characters.
Oh yeah, you don't feel bad. And so you and Aerith,
your character's morally gray. Your dude Barrett there's got a hand that's like half a machine already. It's not just any machine; it's a full rotating gun. It's not just a gun; it's a rotating gun. So, anyways, yeah. And Tifa's like can hit thing herself is just based on gambling. She got the 777. Get the massive. So, anyways, carry on.
Yeah,
they're not moral paragons. Is my point, but it's part of the whole threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very very cyberpunk, punk rocky type of, you know, characters. Except for Aerith, who's pretty clean for the most part, kind of the purest.
Whereas the purest then gets sacrificed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's bigger. That's I'm not there yet in the story.
Why don't we just say that and not get to that? Besides yeah. that, I'll take the that's a non thing. That's good enough to say.
Oh yeah, I don't remember enough. To be honest, I can't remember that. I can't remember how it all gets there. To that.
It's all good. It's all good. We don't even have to talk about that. We can get past that too. Long and short of it is like, you know, they get to this thing after that. Let's keep going because we got to get us into we got to get us back into Shinra.
Yep. Well, so to get into the mansion, Aerith decides because Tifa's in there and you want to help your friend out, and Aerith, you know, they don't know why she's gone in there, but they're going to try to help. So they decide to increase their chances to dress Cloud up as a woman. So it starts the cross dressing quest where you go and you can pick what kind of dress you get. You can win a wig in a squatting contest, which is kind of a joke that I think plays better now with the gym rat culture. You know, kind of back in full force. That joke's really good again because you have all these guys in this gym just calling each other bro, and it's a
bro.
It's kind of hilarious, but they challenge you to a squat contest, and if you beat them, you get the best wig for whatever reason. And then you can
for whatever reason. Yeah. Go on.
And so you get all sorts of you got perfume, and then but here's the weird part. So you can actually go into the House of Ill Repute, called the Honeybee Inn, I think is what it's called.
The Rising Sun.
I mean, similar, except that they're just as bees.
Right on.
Yeah. And so you can go.
Honeycomb hideout? Okay, yeah. Go on.
So you can get a membership card and go in there, and they will actually do your makeup for you if you do the right steps.
There's a bunch of little things in that game which make it really valuable for replay, especially in that era. I mean, the people say now everything goes so fast, and then people still somehow have time for Breath of the Wild or Final Fantasy. Anyways, carry on. I'm not casting stones. I'm simply saying it's a weird paradox. Go on.
So what you can do in there is actually eavesdrop and look through the keyhole of these two rooms on the east side of the Honeybee.
There's a girl in one of them in there, like lapped in. I can't remember.
No, it wasn't anything like it was kind of a joke. I guess if you listen, it sounds bad. But if you look in there, it's like this sort of like old guy and his grandkids who like were trying to get a nice room for the night. And they're in this brothel. Okay,
there you go.
Right. It was kind of a subtle like joke. And then you look in this other one, and this is where the Lynchian element comes into. And I'm trying to remember all the quotes, but it's like this devil summoning ritual thing kind of going on.
That's
it's like
right.
Red tinted and everything. It's like this really weird scene, and Shinra's is involved, and they mention some of the things that go in later in the game, but it's like this whole like Red Queen like summoning thing. It's awesome.
That's cool. Nah, you know, I think I thought there was a chick in there because I remember that's what you're supposed to think, but then that's right. There's some crazy surprises that are non. That's funny. Go on though. So we gotta fast forward this a little bit. So we keep going. So we want to get to the. Yeah, keep going.
Oh yeah. So basically, you go in there. You get you rescue or not rescue Tifa, depending how it goes. You know. But Don Corneo ends up pulling a lever and sends you in the sewers. You know, classic cartoon villain style. And as you're working your way out, though, you I guess at some point you hear that they're gonna blow up. They're going to blow up one of the entire plates. That's because Midgar, like the higher class part of it, sits above the slum. So it's like this big series
of Futurama, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they were just going to drop a plate on Sector 7, which is where all the characters are from. Most of the main characters are from in this game, at least at the beginning. And so, yeah. And so this starts.
Is it Sector 7? Is that what they call it?
Or Section 7, or whatever it is.
Well, whatever. Go on. Sorry, I'm not and fucking. I'm trying to figure something out. And go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's Sector 7. I could be wrong though. So you go back.
Seriously,
there.
It's all good. Thank you.
Yeah, climb up there. Try to get up there. basically that plan goes bad. They nab Aerith, and then that puts you guys in the position where you're trying to rescue her by sneaking into Shinra Corp. Which I have done. So you get over to Shinra Corp after there's some story building stuff with meeting Aerith's mom and figuring out that she's an ancient, which is kind of a big deal for the story. But
I think that's why we're going through this actually. Like, yeah. We shouldn't shit on this because these are actually some kind of important concepts. And there it is, the moment that I realized I need to put the explicit button on this one. Carry on.
Gotcha. So
I really am trying to watch my languages. But yes, Aerith is an ancient, but like we want to tell this thing, but like we want to keep good. Yeah, we'll get there quickly enough.
Yeah, so because of the plot reasons, Barrett's adoptive daughter, I believe adoptive, is Aerith took her out of the slums, you know, at the last second, took her to her house. Her mom's looking over her, but Reno came in and snatched her, and you fail saving the Sector 7 slums. And so the rest of the Avalanche team is gone. As far as we know at this point, I think they're all gone. I don't recall. And then, you know, basically Aerith's mom goes through this whole story about, you know, she go by the train station, went for her husband to come back. Very classic story, coming back from the war. He never came, but this woman with her child just dies there in front of the train, with the only explanation is that this happened all the time back then. And then there was this little girl who's Aerith, that Aerith's adopted mother that took care of her. But it turns out she's an ancient who's the last of this, you know, very powerful bloodline, I believe. I'm trying to remember all the details. It's been a while. And they haven't done all the convoluted ancient lore just yet. This is just their introduction. And like I said, it's been 20 years. And FF7 was not my big game, but that's where her importance comes into the story. And naturally there's probably other ancients within the game too, but I'm not gonna go into spoilers. But she's important
because ancients she's got sound the, like Nephilim.
Noted. Okay, cool. Sorry, I didn't know how to react to that.
You don't have to know anything. That's a lot about life, dude. We're all just like actually like a lot of it is just what you choose to do, and then it's dealing with that. It's wanting to think that there were people who came before us that necessarily have all the answers, and no one does, except for maybe the truth is that, you know, you are when you figure out like enough little like secret moves and super effective ways at understanding what it is to live in yourself. And do that and no bullshit, call yourself on the processes, you know, and like getting away from the things that you need to get away from and going towards the things you need to, even if it's hard, like work is good, 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 good. Just do it. And I'm just saying this on behalf of like, you know, what's the use of like these stories that we're talking about right now? And we're going to get to this, but like, we're trying to live in a world right now. Six of Swords is a podcast you're listening to in a world that you're in right now. And there's a lot of forces out there. And what's most important is that you orientate yourself inside and battle these forces within yourself so that you're not subject to the forces outside of yourself. It's a really basic, quick, simple thing. But the stories in Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 9, specifically these three specifically, those three are solid portrayals of a cosmogony occurring coextant right now with our own. These are quote unquote real. This is not fiction. These are realities. And these are ways of understanding the world we're in right now. As long as you literally are the proverbial ones who have, well, you know how it goes. So anyways, Evan, take us home. What's going on? And why is the creature's name like crazy interesting? And even the main quote unquote antagonist, well, definitely antagonist, Sephiroth. You know, well, you say that, I'll say it. It's Sephiroth. It sounds like Sephiroth. In fact, today I was teaching someone who, you know, there's people who are really cool out there who just can like pick up on this stuff if you understand. Like, there's a part of me that's glad to accept that there's something deeply resonant in my subconscious about being Christian, yeah, and then I go, but that's not right.
but it's, there's something ish there. It's like Jew-ish. It's like Christian-ish. And the point is that in these, you see something manifesting in the world is like, you know, psychic phenomena or how numbers work or what astrology seems to be, or what tarot even seems to be. In the Christian cosmogony, I found this is called the face of God. It's what the world looks like. It's how God looks. So even like when you see some psychic profound clairvoyance I display, these kind of things are but the face of God. And sometimes it works to accept that, you know, we don't create everything. And it's something very useful when we look into what, like, what happens when, like, we're going to jump to Final Fantasy IX later, but they go into trance, for example, or these other things. So in Final Fantasy VII, they also have something what happens when they get kind of like spiritually activated, so to say. So if you're a created creature, all right, and you said that they were like, what was that? The ancients had these kind of like powers that go through them, or like, you know, whatever you're about to find in Shinra, like you find out if you're a created creature and then you can have like these like psychic powers and like, you can actually realize that there are god forms and egregores and entities and things like that. And there are actually ancient bloodline families that are still here propagating themselves, trying to cause psychic changes in a massive war of magicians that actually is taking place all within the mainframe, not only of Final Fantasy VII, but your dear own Earth here, Lings. So anyways, carry on with the storyline. Let's see how we can tie it all around. And I think there's some Pink Floyd coming up.
Okay, so hopefully we'll get there. I'll bring. We're almost to the point where I stopped because I remember parts of this. So
yeah, go ahead.
So I go. You know, you got two ways to approach the Shinra. You can either the Shinra headquarters. You can either bust through the bottom door or go up the staircase. I'm a stealthy guy. I like stealth in games, so I went up the side staircase.
I knew you did.
Yeah, so I went up the side staircase and got through there. Which puts you inside the corporate, like, upper crust levels. Work your way through some rooms or some puzzles and get some cool loot, some nice materia. And then you go, and where I am and where I stopped is I follow the, and I forgot his name, the mad scientist who's kind of behind it all.
Are you about to get Red 13?
Yes, and I stopped right as I got in that room, and I had to save.
I thought that's where you were. I got a feeling. I got an imprint. Yep. That's where you were right now.
Yep, and that's exactly so. I got the first look at Genova in the tank, which is
still supposed to be like Jehovah.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of a dark, you know. Well, maybe. I mean, I guess it's kind of got a Gnostic, you know, kind of bent to it a little bit, maybe. That's the reason I'm appreciating this game again, because I'm looking at it from a...
It's called Sephiroth and Genova, which are both Kabbalistic or Jewish-ish kind of concepts, right? Jehovah is a name in the Abrahamic, you know, religion. It's like a name of God or a power name. And it's interesting that, you know, maybe they're blaming someone for explosions of atomic I don't know, it just seems like, why would you use those? I totally am not going anywhere close to that. It's just like, why name that? That's the question. Anyways, further on, it's totally neutral milk hotel on that, just saying.
Yep, so I have not talked to Red 13 yet. I had to stop right there, but I do remember, and I remember that room, and I remember being, you know, 10, 11, 12, however old I was, and I remember the feel of that room, and it is still pretty haunted. Like there's something there, you know, there's haunted images. The first look at Genova in the tank, Red 13. Absolutely. There, and just sort of the sadness and desperation, and just how good of a character Red 13 is. I haven't heard a line of dialogue from him in years, and I can still remember the voice, like, you know,
I am the reading a voice. Dog person, so like, you know, I know he's a catish type lion dude because I also have an affinity, but mainly I just like the fact that he's kind of like, you know, in a really large way, he's your dog body, you know, he's your big lion dog body and your big genetic freak lion dog body, and he's fucking awesome. He's awesome. I mean, like, we've got him. We're not at Kate Sith yet. We're not at Yuffie or like Sid. God bless Sid. Sid's the
yeah,
man.
None of them yet. I'm still in the
yeah. We need
the
to
first,
we need,
the first need act, up, I guess.
Yeah, we're at. We have about an hour left, but there's a good reason for telling this in this way. But let's carry it on because we got a few more questions for you and some other stuff. But let's get around to that too. Go on.
Well, that's and so that's pretty much where I left off, and I don't and I remember the and I remember the boss fight, and I remember the motorcycle scene. I remember some of the other towns and characters, but that's pretty much where my memory kind of leaves off. And I never did beat Final Fantasy VII entirely back in the day. So this is going to be my first full playthrough when
Then we won't finish it for you, and then we'll leave it for the audience too. That's fun.
Yeah. So I'm hoping to, but there's a like, I don't know. I just got the feeling I need to play it, so I think you're kind of right on it. I think. But it brings me to kind of a bigger conversation since we were talking about these, you know, these Japanese creatives making these games with a lot of Western motifs in them, I guess you'd call
Japanese
that.
Creatives? Is that like an offshore tax haven?
Well, people from, you know.
What is this Japanese creatives? Is there like
people tiny from Japan who
tiny
are.
Tiny umbrellas involved?
Yeah. People from. You know, Japan, who are creating a game based on Western culture, is what
okay,
I
so
say.
That's such a okay.
Well, no. Well, I like it because I've been finding a lot of value in what happens when you have one, you know, set culture and perspective looking at another
off. Look. Let's talk about. Well, honestly, like I don't think I can do anything to fix all of the thing with the cultural things and such. Like,
a fixing thing. I thought it was just. I think that liminality between when you're taking something that's from a different language and a different, you know, perspective, and then you lovingly sort of base something in it. I think it kind of in that liminal space in between. I don't know. I've just always noticed that. If you read between the lines, you get some really profound stuff. And
what
I really
are you
like
saying it. Right now?
I'm saying with Final Fantasy VII, between the imagery and the use of these things like the Midgar and Genova and the Sephiroth, you kind of create a form of weird truth and when you find and look at it, if I'm explaining that correctly.
I think we just stepped a few pages leftwards, but I'm fine to do so.
Oh, hey, sorry. And that's how I've been kind of looking at this stuff lately, as I'm going back to old games I used to play and stuff that resonated with me in a certain way. And looking at why it's so powerful, right? Because if you look at it from a more academic standard in terms of the writing and storytelling, some of it would be, you know, if we're going to be on our Alabaster Tower, you know.
Or you could just be chilling on the stoner couch in the lounge with the good music and the black light and the snacks.
Well, that's where we want to be. But
let's do that.
You know, because I
do. Oh, we got to go to Alabaster. We're going to Alabaster. Let's go.
You want to go Alabaster?
I thought you wanted to. Did you want to?
No, I don't want to go Alabaster. I'm just saying if you look at...
Oh, fuck Alabaster. Let's go.
You know, if you look at some of the dialogue and stuff from that position, it's not good in a classical, you know, English writing sense, right?
It's not supposed to be, right? It, actually,
well, I know.
It is when you think about it, because they're mastering the language so much to do that kind of fuckery that you can only do if you know what you're doing. Like, that's when you come... They're playing with it. It's really good, actually.
No, I love it. I'm just like, so I was just kind of pointing out, like, you do not get to appreciate that stuff if you're not looking at it with a certain kind of, you know.
So I guess like all of this is to say, though, that we're like, you know, one of the main tenets of the show is healing. And healing is such like a, I don't know. I think it's like I really like to just quickly add that it's always about living like a good life. Just like, you know, the best, you know, live well. It's the best healing is living well. You know, it's not about being in that like, I don't know. It's about living well. So anyways, like long story short, like one of the things that we get out of these stories are these ways to like focus on these narratives and angles of life that otherwise would go ignored completely. Like myths are super important. I took a mythology course once upon a time with a professor who was like a crane. He was very wise and I appreciated him. I was actually, Good man. Anyways, one of the points is like we read the Kalevala in that class. We read like Kayak, and what you would say an Eskimo myth. Don't give me that crap. It was just Eskimo myth. And it was an amazing story, like freaking cool. And there was like so many other things like the Prose Edda we read. And so all of these different ways of looking at the world, right? They're just like you're talking about, they're condensing these different myths and archetypes. So you mentioned the two from the Nordic and then the Shinra or whatever, the Genova, the Hebraic. But So the it's like for them, it's alien. You know, it's like for us, if we were trying, you know what I mean? And they even do the Japanese to Chinese thing where they like take what, you know, and the Japanese, and you want to talk about culture, you know, like the Japanese had traditionally loathed the Chinese, right? Like they treated them as they were inferior too, especially, you know what I mean? Like that was a whole thing. Mm-hmm. Very much so. Like Japanese saw themselves as the European nobility, basically. Long story short is that they took those different cultures and made a real world out of them. And now there's something like easier about us looking at these different laterally connected magical ideas that makes it easier for us to be effective in this world. Evan?
Yeah. What's up? Thanks for putting it that way. And exactly. It's that, and again, it's that, it's almost, it almost frees it up in a way when you take that, when you do that. Because I've noticed that with, we talked about Zelda earlier, and I know, I don't think you're big on Dark Souls yet until I convert you.
Can't. It's impossible. I have to play through so many Zeldas and Final Fantasies first. By the time we get there, I don't know if we're still going to be around for video games.
Yeah. If you get there, I'll probably end up sending you some videos. That, you know, even that same thing where you have all this sort of these Welsh names coming in, Lovecraftian elements coming in from, you know, and it's, you know, and it's another Miyazaki. That's a great name for creatives.
It shows people's pedigrees and people calling people creatives. I got to throw a hammer at that, but go ahead.
Sorry. I just, the common nomenclature, the current nomenclature.
What kind of common? Choose your own.
The people that made the things.
How about Nerf? That's all right. Let's keep going. All
right. That's what happens when I use my own. I just say things and stuff. That's all I do.
All right. Let's go.
It's got to have a template.
I appreciate that. I'm in the same club. It's good. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, but I absolutely love it. On a side, I don't want to go off too much on a tangent, but if you listen to like European power metal bands, and especially ones that English is not their first language, some of the stuff they come up with lyrically is amazing.
For sure, dude. I was listening to The Pillows last night. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and
they're not European. They're back to Japanese, but yeah, dude, they're for sure awesome.
There's a French, I believe, power metal band called Heavenly.
And they had an album. My God, I need to check this out.
Yeah, they're good. I mean, the singer's got like a rad falsetto. I haven't listened to them in a while. I don't know if they're still make albums, but they have an
falsettos
album called...
Okay, go ahead.
They have an album called Sign of the Winner, which was clearly meant to be Sign of the Victor, if you took the right connotation of the word, but it's brilliant stuff like that. Blind Guardian's older stuff has a lot of that. Really,
we got into like metal, like fucking. I love Opeth and you know, Dimmu Borgir, Dark Tranquility, man. These were good things.
Yeah. Well, Michael Ackerfeldt's really good at English. I don't think he doesn't have too much.
Oh, it's not. Yeah, I was just talking about like good metal, like Porcupine Tree. I was just kind of. I feel like these things need to be mentioned. If you haven't, have you ever heard, Evan, of The Sky Moves Sideways?
That sounds really familiar, but I don't think I have a fair enough familiarity with them.
It's a Porcupine Tree album.
Yeah.
From 1994, I want to say. And it's utter genius. It's got all of these little, like, sub album aspects within it. And there's different, like, orderings you can listen to. There's a proper three vinyl order album. There's another one just that's you know, just Moon Loop itself. So there's a song called Moon Loop that we listened to on the JJ and I listened to on the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, and that was cool to listen to as a kind of marking the occasion, and given all the JFK moon land, anyways, one thing at a time now, one step at a time, even if it's a huge, anyways. That's more like some saxophoning, but anyways, Colossus. So here's the point, dude. JJ and I were like listening to this Porcupine Tree song called Moon Loop. It's only one track. That one itself is like 40 minutes long, but the entire, like, you know, it's basically in of itself is a Shine On You Crazy Diamond conceit. Basically, it's like got this huge suite called The Sky Moves Sideways, and there's a couple of other tracks, like one's called Stars Die. It's a must listen to. In fact, it's so good, the entire like greatest hits like remastered versions called Stars Die discs 1 and 2 or something like that. the album itself is a psychedelic art masterpiece. And I'm hoping it's this point in the conversation that we can turn to talking about the luminaries, like such as Stanislav Grof, Thomas McKenna, and Terence McKenna, and Stanislav Grof, Terence McKenna, and Manly P. Hall. These type of people. I can't believe that Thomas. I'm totally editing. It's hilarious. How stoned am I, Terrence? I mean, Thomas.
Yeah, I'm a, you know, and for a guy that's never. Sorry.
I love you, man. This is fun. These keep going.
I'm a guy who's never touched a shroom, but I probably read way more Terrence McKenna for a guy that's never. I haven't really needed to. Thomas McKenna. Yeah, Thomas McKenna, great. Great writer of Westerns.
I think he's going to be a character in a book I do now. That's going to have to be a thing. All right, Jesus. All right, I love my brain. All right, we're going to talk about Viktor Frankl, Erich Fromm, and Thomas McKenzie. Okay, go on.
Yeah, I think McKenna's the only one I really have a good working familiarity with in terms of I've like read a few of his books and stuff like that. Which he did it in. Terrence did come in within sort of my initial, I guess, Pete Carroll, you know, a little bit of Robert Anton Wilson. The when I was 23, as appropriate as it were, that was the age where the official dive into chaos magic kind of came in. And so that was a pretty good year for that, I think. I think 2023 kind of hits that nice little itch right there.
Have you ever heard the song Vignette Trace by Tool?
I think it's listened
10,000 days.
Yeah, I just listened to the big one the other day because Tool stuff is
the big
they
one.
They kind of loosen up the accessibility on it.
Oculum.
Yeah, there we go. And I did a straight listen through that, but was not looking at every track name.
Oh, good man! You listened to the whole thing like through. Was it the physical copy or the digital copy?
Digital copy. I just had I listened to it while driving around and stuff. It's one of those that I'm finally biting the bullet on. I kind of had a weird, not that I disliked the band, but everybody that was kind of into Tool, I felt like being contrarian because it's just who I am. So I'm coming around on it now. I'm kind of revisiting stuff that I was too immature, you know, in my contrarian nature to give an appropriate amount of time and focus to.
It sounds like a relevant theme that you might find in Tool adjacent bands.
Yeah, very possible. I like kind of going back and going to those things from the 2000s because, you know, while everybody was doing that kind of stuff, I was like, well, no, I'm going to go to the European power metal bands or whatever.
I'm talking about Pussifer.
That's right.
There's a song called The Contrarian.
Yeah. God, I haven't heard Pussifer in forever.
I liked a few of their songs quite a bit. I was at a record store day where I picked up a Pixies album, Indie Cindy, and I got the bonus vinyl on that Women of War chill track. And what happened, I believe that's Paz on that one. Is it? No, I think it's, who's the other? Kenny Shattuck? Was it of the Moths God Rest, man? So anyways, I forget who was on that track suddenly, just brain farting, but it was cool. We'll get around to that someday. Women of War is a cool track if you haven't heard it. I was there and they had this Pussifer album, just gigantic vinyl, like obviously 12-inch, like bright red and blue clashing, super like war, like almost Warhol-esque, like clashing colors. I forget, like I don't know if there's a good artist's name that would really evoke that, but it was just super like 70s cartoon, like almost like you could see the impact of the era that certain people grew up in, just like pouring through, like in this like totally post like, I don't know. It's just, it is what it is. You could feel it or you don't. It's just, it is what it is. So anyways, man, it was like just gaudy AF. I had at that point wanted nothing to do with it. I was happy to pick up a copy of Talking Heads' Naive Melody. This Must Be the Place, with on the back a band called Echo Smith. And the version that you'll find on this vinyl copy is divine. You won't find it online anywhere. It's just a different one on the online. But this one is superb. The feeling the warmth. Anyways, I got that Pixies album, The Talking Heads. I think I got some other. Oh, I got the Ghostbusters Glow in the Dark vinyl that day. But that's a long story short, Pussifer. And, you know, that was just not something that I wanted to like be looking at all the time. And it felt like if you own that, you'd want to put it somewhere and look at it. It felt like it was worthy of art, like being looked at. It just wasn't for my collection right now, then. Anyways, long story short, we got a few things to talk about. On this show, we do ask 6 questions. I think you're familiar with this practice, and we shall spring the same thing on you right now. All right, so the first is, where is the best, Evan, you're in the Texas area-ish, but you can choose anywhere in wherever, but use where you know. Where is the best camping spot?
Ooh. I don't think I found the best. I was in Boy Scouts for like 12 years, so I'm going to go through and think. You know,
that's cool. I didn't know that about you. That's neat.
Yeah. My dad was a scoutmaster.
That's really cool. I was a Boy Scout myself for quite a long time. That's cool, man.
Yep. You know, my favorite kind of just like local place, I need to kind of branch out. I want to go camping more. That's kind of a resolution in the making.
Sure.
Cause I've not gone much lately.
Where's the best one that you found so far?
I like Cleburne State Park, which is, not too far from me. It's really not great in terms of, I guess, the actual campsite itself, but it has this rad spillway there that and I'll just go out hiking there sometimes. There's a small man-made lake and you have this, spillway that's just kind of this, I guess the best thing I could say is a giant trench. I'd say it's probably 20 feet, I guess, deep, right? I guess if you were down in the bow of it, the top of it's probably, I don't know, 15, 20, it seems tall, but it's these stone steps that move up on either side. And if you have these 3 tiers that each have a pool in them, and it's like something out of Lord of the Rings. It's
rather like, than a pool of tears out of Alice in Wonderland. I know. Carry on.
Don't know if I cried in them. I might have.
It's all right, as long as you don't drink things that you haven't read the labels on. Carry on.
Yeah, don't want to drink that the stagnant water.
Really, so yeah, it's like something of a mathematical Fibonacci principle that will reorganize your entire mechanical constitution, but carry on.
Yeah, so, and for whatever reason, that spillway, it just always comes to mind. I had a lot of fun there. We went camping there a lot as a kid, when I was a kid. And so it was just something about it. It just looked like an ancient ruin. Even though it's a purely utility thing, right?
But it feels like that.
If you just imagine like a giant half pipe, except the sides of it are made of these stone steps.
Yeah. Okay. I get you. Like an amphitheater almost.
Almost. Yeah. So it just kind of funnels the water down. It's just meant for overflow.
Sure. I think I know exactly what you're. Yep. I bet that shit came from aliens. That design. No, I'm just I don't know. So your favorite camping spot is an alien hotspot. Okay, cool to know. Actually, I'm going to ask this question of like some really cool people amongst. So like, we're going to start charting like who likes where. I shouldn't fucking put this out there. Okay, well, I'll figure it out. I'll spring it on them somehow. When we get them on here, we'll say we're not asking the campings question. Then we'll ask the camping. I don't know. Figure it out. I'll just edit this out. Maybe, definitely not. It'll be good. What's your favorite spicy dish?
Hot wings.
Oh, easy one. All right.
Probably my favorite food too. So
do you think so? It could be. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think I probably crave that even more than like, you know, steak or anything like that. I will probably.
What's your favorite dipping sauces? You get like multiple.
Well, just the sauce in the wing or what you dip it into.
I mean, yes.
Yeah. Cause, typically what I'll do is I'll go for the most reasonably hot one, which is usually like if you go to Buffalo Wild Wings, that's the wild sauce, wild with a W. If you do a Wingstop, that's
We're not going to do advertisements.
I'm just giving an example.
It's wild with a W, bitches. Eat it, Wild Wings.
Sorry, I'm a hot wing enthusiast, probably to my detriment.
No, dude, that's all good. We got a place around here that's called Fireflies that you actually have to send a waiver to get the hot sauce on the top shelf. I've always been a hot sauce junkie. I mean, it doesn't mean like I can handle everything. Some stuff is like, oh boy, who, you know, I mean, like, don't make it up. If you can't handle it, do not go in like an asshole. Pardon my language, but it's a true thing. So, I mean, like when you say spicy dish, you like that. I'm going to do 3 questions in a row. Who would you most like to meet? And the answer is yes. Just who would you most like to meet? Whatever questions you have, yes. Who would you most like to meet?
Right now, I'd say maybe Graham Hancock.
Oh, yeah.
He seems like he would be a good one. I've had a few short conversations with some other guys recently. It'd be nice to meet them. But I guess if who I'd like to pick his brain and talk to would probably be Graham Hancock right now.
And what about your we're doing four. What's your favorite type of animal?
Dog.
And what's the best planet?
For some reason, I thought Saturn was the first one that came to mind.
All right. And what's your purpose in life?
Ooh. I guess it would be to better facilitate our relationship to the magical and mystical landscape.
You and I are on the same team. I am digging that answer.
Yeah, this is fun. We've covered most of the ground so far. We're in the final third of the show coming up. And of course, this is the Midtro, where you get your above $50, which is $49 and under, is anonymity purposes. And if you'd like your $49.49 donation, that is a popular one. One that gets you eventually to playing the Value for Value role-playing game, and that will be happening during the Six of Wands that is coming up at the end-ish of this month. It's not the final Sunday, but it is the second to final Sunday, and that will be on, I believe, since it's February the 6th. Yes, it is the 16th. So Sunday evening, look for the Six of Wands in the Six of Swords Discord, and you'll be able to access that. And of course, it's always appreciated whenever you donate, but I know that you do love the show, and you're going to get more and more out of it as you go. We all are. As you're going to hear in the final third here, it's really exciting when you donate, and you'll be able to do that at occultfan@gmail.com. Wow. Yeah, that makes sense. At occultfan@gmail.com when you're over there, and when you're at occultfan.com, you'll go and hit the donate button. One last and third and fourth time before I come up with a fancy jingle to get it done for me. You go to occultfan.com/WOH or just on the homepage. You'll still catch it there. And hit the donate button. Go to the PayPal. Bob's your uncle. Enter the amount that you like. Say the note that you want in there. If it's within a reasonable amount over, you can always feel free to email me further at occultfan@gmail.com. Of course, if you're in the Midtro section, you should just have a note that can fit in a PayPal. Anyways, you know how that goes. Anyways, how many M&E do you want? It's like there's a bowl full of M&Ms, but they all say anyways on them. So back to the show soon. Thank you again for listening. But this is only getting better with time. I'm looking forward to leading into this. There's a whole new level of creation and perfection and alchemy coming into play. And less flowery, more to the point, less BS, more useful. It's always about improving, just... And again, if you think that the trickster is the top of things... The trickster is the deceiver. The deceiver is the betrayer. You cannot trust that this is the top of all things. If the betrayer was the top of all things, then everything would have fallen apart by now. It's just a thought experiment. I think that there's something beyond the trickster that keeps things going. It's benign, ultimately, I think. But what do I know? Anyways, just pondering thoughts at the middle of the mid-tro. And we're going to get back into the show now, and I want to thank you again for listening, and we'll have a bit more to go here. It's good. I'd say we're getting good, but we already got good, so it's getting gooder and greater. So with that, thank you, and let's get back into it now, shall we?
All right, so that was the mid-tro. Those are always fun. They're more fun when you hear about how people have donated in them and the exploits of those people who have been part of the Six of Swords Value for Value role-playing game. In this game, you're going to end up running into interdimensional beings, and not just talking about the kind that are on the game board. This is a interdimensional game itself. It has got a tripartite system. It's Your donation goes into the show for the value you get for what you're listening to. You decide that. If you want to donate $4.20, if you want to donate €4.20, if you want to donate 420 Australian dollar do's, because it is part of the value for value offshoot. Love to know agenda and crackpot and buzzkill. Yeah, man, definitely love to them. And like, yeah, you donate money, like, yeah, bro, and you get real value out of this show, so you get real value into it. And then the next part is those who donate the highest for that month will end up, you'll end up, is that a thing you want to do, ending up, you'll get to participate. That sounds better. It doesn't really matter. The point is you get in on this, you end up fighting these interdimensional beings in this quote-unquote fictional game, and you end up earning different points, and you end up getting real. Well, anyways, we're getting ahead of ourselves. There's a upshot to having a loving jeweler and metalsmith who makes rock star jewelry that Elton John's favorite band wears, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, while there are material rewards that come through in the kind of material way, which Evan and I have talked about before in other contexts, which, you know, since, you know, it's this project we're free to talk about here, obviously, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
Long story short, you end up running into Men in Black in these things. And the last one, if you listen to it, the Six of Wands, you find out that one of the Men in Black characters like throws this like Ghostbusters type box down, and it's containing what eventually turns out to be a djinn type spirit. And I don't know if you listened to it, but each one had different types of elemental guns to try to figure out a way to incorporate the thrice, you know, common Final Fantasy element of the, in seven, you have the fire. We haven't, you know, we could talk for eons about each game, but basically we wanted to talk about what the shape of that game looked like, what the shape of our world today looks like, and the real psychic quest that we're all going on. So let's finish strong with these kind of concepts, because I think this has been, I really love what we're doing. This has been a great episode so far, and I think we're going to finish even stronger. So while the owls are not what they seem, let's take us home with what we're talking about just prior to my Twin Peaks reference.
Psychic questing?
Absolutely.
All right. What do you want to know about psychic questing?
Well, I think it's more along the lines of what are we doing with it in our lives right now by using the value for value role-playing game. Let's tie it in that way. I think that's a great, wouldn't you say that's a great
way? Ooh, yeah. And I definitely think there's some traction with the use of role-playing games. And then,
yeah, let's talk about the VFVRPG. So people, well, what I, and just to finish what I'm saying. So if you're obviously the value for value role-playing game is when you donate at the executive level or the executive producer slash associate executive producer level, that's anything above 200, anything that's under 200 at $199.99 American, and up to above 50, 50 is a cutoff, $49.99. You do for anonymity or for other reasons. If you want to donate $49.49, that's a good luck number. It's an anonymous, but it's good luck. So furthermore, when you go on and you end up having the highest of the, you know, we have up to four slots per month. You have four different characters that can participate each month in the game. And when you have the highest that donation amount, you obviously get access to doing that. You know, don't fret if you're not in that month. I have ways of making sure that it gets fair enough during times when, like, certain people are just creaming the market. But the idea is that when you get in there, you're going to be able to use that money to buy items in the game. Certain people who have listened to Six of Wands, by the way, because I do legacy things, I believe in legacy programs. I appreciate, like, what the medium that I'm on, Simplecast, right now is doing this legacy thing. So that's good. So people who have listened in the past have like these ridiculously cool weapons they have the right to use when they donate, all this different jazz. You know what I mean? You care about the people who care, you know, about what you do. But the long story is short that you end up getting donations into the show that you're getting value out of. You're feeding a con, you know, and you can also choose if you're not going to be like in the campaign, you can give your monies in the game to other people. You can say, there's a bank in the game where you store your money and say, all right, that's in there. It's like, oh yeah, no, that's fine. They can have it. If you're not going to, you can still donate to the show, and you see how that works. So someone else could be benefiting from your angel funding like that. So that's really cool too. And it ties into good karma in ways that, you know, that it works. We all know it. It's why it's the VFVRPG. It's just thank you and for your courage. And the long story short is that how could we get this psychic questing to tie in with the actual monetary energy, with the actual psychic energy, and with the actual like real, like, you know, weird stuff happened after I had Men in Black on this episode with Mothmen as one of the mini bosses.
Okay, so
I feel like you grokked what I just said. So
yeah, I grokked what you said. So I'm trying to break it down. So if we're going to talk about, so let's talk a little bit about the a certain bit of reading material that's been a hyper sigil, right? Like something a famous one being Grant Morrison's
Invisibles.
The Invisibles, yes, a certain piece of a forbidden reading material
based off of the Invisible College.
Yes, so that you know, Grant Morrison sets up the Invisibles as a hyper sigil, right? So in a way, he is, by inserting himself as a character into this thing, he has created a hyper sigil. And I've had some recent experiences as a dungeon master where, yep, there it is, right there. Yep. Showing off a copy of Invisibles. I love it.
It's a pair of kit gloves slid into a few books. One of them is Anarchy for the Masses, and the other one is Our Sentence is Up. But carry on, please.
Yeah, so by inserting his character into this narrative, he made things happen. And I've dungeon mastered a few times where I've started bringing in motifs. Like, I might just be pulling from mythology. I'm like, you know, I want some, you know, want some Apep and some Ra and Horus type characters in here. Not name those things, just kind of like based on them. You know, maybe there's a, you know, oh, some great hero that died and you got to escort his, you know, sarcophagi through, you know, this thing.
Oh, Orphic then, of you.
Yes, very, very Orphic of me. And things end up, I got to get rid of a pop-up here. Okay. Cancel.
I got him excited with the Orphic comment.
Yeah. Yeah. You can, you know, I started getting more references to these things in my, you know, life and existence around me. I had a friend of mine that's a bit of a psychic, had her do a blind tarot, and all of a sudden she just starts pulling all this stuff, like, and she's not even in Egypt, like, she didn't know who these things were, and it was...
Well, I think it's because we're, you know, we are connected to that higher force, you know, the all force, and that's absolutely just the connection. That's just what it is. And the green language is, like, that coming through, not being filtered, like, the dark side of the moon prism, you know, the cover of that, which, like... You could totally see, like, the backward side of the prism being the other world in Zelda when you flip through the other side of the mirror, like, through the looking glass, and there's your connection to bring that around. But, yeah, so carrying on.
Or even stuff that's more important than that. So you could definitely leverage that into your role-playing thing, especially if a game is designed to kind of
more important?
You could leverage that into the game that you're doing if it's being part of your life, right? If you're integrating it in a way that's meaningful. And some others have done this before. I haven't done it as a magical experiment with things like Habitica or something like that.
You know what I found out earlier? Can you tell me that in a second? Do you know what I found out earlier, by the way? It was like this really cool thing about how it took two humans to get you here, right? Like think of a letter Y. Took two humans to get you here, and like, so mom, dad, baby. Now, in all things in life, there's a choice you can make. You can be an upward spiraler or a downward spiraler. Upward spiralers are successful people. They're successful because they want to see other people succeed. The downward spiralers are the crabs in the buckets trying to pull other people down because they're limited. You see, their universe is ultimately frozen and shrunken. It's decayed and it never grows again. However, the upward spiralers leave this concept in their hearts always, and that is the why that it took two people to get there. And this is the why of life, that you should always consider everything that you do in life to, if you get successful with something, consider a way that you can make, I'm serious, two people successful by what you're doing. How can you make two more people successful by what you're doing? So that's you, as that's the baby that came out of the mom and dad. I'm not talking about just like having children. I'm talking about any way of creation in life. How could you make two things happen that are good in the world, basically, is the long story short of that. And if you live with that, that's like a fundamental secret about being a good person on this planet. That is like legitimately a good thing you can do for your evolution of your spirit. It's just a good dude, good chick, whatever you are, whoever you are, good kind of way to be. And so that's something I figured out earlier. So, yeah, what you got?
Yeah, and that's where Yeah, so we're still talking like through the role playing thing, right? Exactly. And benefiting from there, yeah.
Right, because we can actuate efficacious change in this world, in this with the denizens of this reality, with people actually having good lives.
Yeah, and then that would only get compounded by creating a narrative around that, and then attributing extra meaning on top of things. Things don't have to be meaningless.
This is why we're doing this right now. Like, we're building it right now.
Yeah, and even if you got to, even if you have to find your meaning in something, it doesn't detract from it, I think.
You're talking to a guy who thinks that there's a holy book inside of a rearranged metal album, so you know, I'm pretty sure I'm in.
I was talking to people at home.
Well, there you go. I was going to also say that I'm also born on Hobbit Day, and for the people at home, hearing these kind of things lets them know that there are vast truths beneath these things. There's tips of the icebergs, which people are used to looking at, and when you get someone who has the life path to be writing about hidden albums, it's not surprising that they're seeing all the other hidden things too, because hidden's kind of just their juju.
Mm-hmm.
I got a 13-degree Saturn in Scorpio, by the way, just to add that. That'll be something that'll come back around in a positive way. But meanwhile, where do you have Saturn in your chart, Evan?
I believe my Sat is in Cap.
Thought so. Thought you had a nicely placed one. You want that, of course. I think Austin Coppock had something called like astrology of the grumpy goat or something in Saturn. Do you feel like a grumpy goat?
I get seen that way sometimes. But I feel it's something I've worked on a lot. So I think I've managed to turn that cynicism into a positive thing.
Good, because otherwise you end up with alien goat vomit, and that's just no good. Anyways, poor Mr. Chunks, he died doing what he loved. In the meantime, yeah, dude, we're gonna like kick it around. We gotta get a few ending remarks here. So by doing this game, people playing this game are doing a similar thing to what people are doing on psychic questing. Like when you go out, like Hellier, like when you mm-hmm. go out, it's basically like No Agenda meets Hellier. It's the value for value role-playing game. It's kind of something like that. So, you know, right, Hank?
Yeah, Hank.
All right, cool, Hank. So what do you think about the idea of psychic questing in specifically, like, let's develop this a little further. Like, how would you see this, like, just one way that this, like, that could, this could be really cool? Like, you're, like, let's say that, you know, you're doing the live Six of Wands, so I'm XMing, as I call it. What's one way that you could see this going really cool? That would be great if you could, I'd appreciate it deeply if you could role play, just, you know, shooting the shit here, what that would look a bit like and how you would have that. Knowing that I use the Final Fantasy IX 4-player, you know, that module as a general basis. Go ahead.
Well, so a degree of randomness from the XM, I think, would help tap into that that great, you know, Orphic storytelling force in the universe.
Can I ask you a question, just to be random, sure, before you? Would it, like, I was thinking about, I saw a friend of ours recently. I know that he's a friend of, I'm sure he'll be, I'm sure y'all are. So I saw a friend of ours, and he talked about wanting to be a Mothman. And I was thinking, like, how cool would it be to have some of our friends come in, like, on the DL? No one knows who they are, but they all play as certain bosses. And I say, all right, you know, besides, like, if I need to do a Deus Ex, you know, you can, like, fucking do your dance and start attacking these people. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's nothing personal. It's just, you know what I mean? So what about that for a degree of randomness? And
I like it. I think the randomness of coming of what's just sort of off the tip of your tongue taps into the calliope of it all. We're going to keep on. I think the Orphic line is probably the best way to look at dungeon mastering or XMing or
what is that phantom toll booth, and it has the conductor who's making the sun rise. So I like to think of myself in that way. Yeah, go ahead, though.
Yeah. So that degree of randomness, I think, in terms of if we're going to magicify our role-playing games, it can happen otherwise, I think, if you're passionate about something. But I've found that the stuff I come up with randomly ends up being the most, like, potent. Like, when you can over-prepare for something, and it can end up being fun, but it's always the random stuff that ends up being...
Yeah, I was reading about Massive Attack's first album, Blue Lines, which is an absolute legendary classic. I was grooving this morning, man, like... What was I listening to? Like, jeez. I think I started off with, like, if it wasn't the Fifth Dimension, I think it was. And then I went into Rolling Stones, Sympathy for the Devil. And then I went into Papa Was a Rolling Stone. So I was all in this, like, super awesome groove. But the whole... What the fuck song was I just talking about? I can't even access like my short-term memory for a second. I need to weed. I need to get weed. I'm going to edit this part out. What was I just saying? What song was before that?
Did you say Papa's a Rolling Stone?
Yeah. But okay, hold on. Okay. What was I saying before that?
God, I lost it too.
What was I saying before?
We lost it.
I don't want to have to stop this and go back and check.
We were talking Mothman. To randomness, to... that being the random being the more magical.
We're getting there. Cause there was something in one of those songs by one of those artists that was talking about, Blue Lines by Massive Attack.
There we go. Massive Attack. That's right.
That's it. All right. No, I won't edit that shit out. I'll just keep that in there. Whatever. So anyways, listen, thank you. Say, don't make me turn this car around. Richard. Okay. So long story short, back to our show. The idea is that Blue Lines had all this like energy to it from Massive Attack. And then like they started to kind of like, I guess he said, like, just from what I got on the Wikipedia, it was talking about how he felt like that was where they had the most raw energy and stuff. So it was a similar thing to that, I think, is what mm-hmm. we're saying.
Or even just the loads of songs that were just made up on the spot that ended up being big hits for bands, things like Paranoid and then Wipeout, and, you know.
Do you know Dick Dale, right?
Like, yeah.
The surf rock dude? He's from Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet dude. Did you know the Wizard Rock band Harry and the Potters is from Norwood, Massachusetts?
No, I did not.
The nicest outer suburbs, according to Bill Burr, along with Canton and Norwood, Mass. Yeah, they're from Wizard Rock band. But yeah, I know that's a thing, right? Of course, that I'm living in the town known for Wizard Rock. You know, okay. As it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
How straight, like, it's like sometimes the green language is just like really obscure, and the other times it's just like
right on. Yeah,
like almost. Okay, so like, let's finish even stronger. What do you think we can make happen if we got people playing this, like, say a little bit more of what you're going on?
Well, degree of randomness, so you kind of get almost like the random number generators. That was something that's been brought up as a kind of alternative psychic questing tool, is taking random points on the map. I forgot if they're called randonauts. There we go. Somebody was sharing those the other day in a Hillier discussion, and I think it tracks pretty well. It's not my method of going about things. I just kind of step outside and look for something cool, some stark imagery. But you could still do that same degree of randomness and very likely find something, because that's just kind of how it works.
Where your attention goes, energy flows, and the standing waves will crystallize, and then it will fade away again, and you'll be left wondering what happened, because it was off the path down a dead-end vein where capillaries are cauterized. For now, though, we have bigger and brighter plans for our futures, and we will use ourselves more efficaciously and uproariously and delightfully up together. With the value for value role-playing game, like, we were casting cool ass spells, and like, we can really see that there's like a larger, more ancient game that's like, or a story or just tale that's being told. And I think it's our time to add some rooms to that mansion. And that's what this game is, in a way. So I want to see some campaigns. Like, what's a campaign that you would like to see? Like, what's a storyline you would like to see, Evan?
I've been wanting to do is I don't know if this will fit. I've always wanted to do like a pioneer type of thing, okay. Where like you're a member of it could be a fantasy
Oregon
based
Trail
one.
Or some shit. Right?
Yeah, kind of like an Oregon Trail. You end up in the
I'm
mountain
with you
pass.
Already. Like Northwest Passage, dude. Like, they got that in the Secret History of Twin Peaks. I'd love to like set one of those in a forest. Thanks, man. You just figured it out. That's the next mm-hmm. one. We'll get lost in a forest there. And so then, you know, the omnipresent floating cloud bank, like a cloud in the tarot coming down, like. if you want to give your donations to other people, that's fine. You can do that. Like I said, but like you got your bank, you can buy items in game. We're going to really solidify greater amounts of how this is going to work. Yeah. I want to say thank you too for like how you helped me with that. That's that wouldn't be really so much. I definitely want to take the time while people are listening to this to give you a very deep and humble, grateful thank you for helping me with even instituting, making that happen in the first place. So Evan, thank you. Evan Walker.
Oh, no problem. And anytime I love role-playing games. I like especially tabletop. I think if you haven't at least tried one and really got into it, you're robbing yourself of a very good experience.
You, it's going to be fun to like have some like, you know, summer, like, you know, 5 day something meetups for like, see if we can like get in the central of the country or something like that, you know, get some like, you know, some reason that it's meeting up maybe is, you know, the center of the whatever, you know, midsummer, whatever. But like, you know, get some actual role playing tabletop with real people or even like, you know, proper, I don't know, we don't have to LARP, but still the idea is that would be fun. Anyways, yeah. So long story short is, okay, so who's a good enemy? What's the story now? We're in the forest. We're already getting some kind of Pixian vibe. So what's going on in this one?
Yeah. I mean, it can really be anything, and that's where you start to decide what the troubles are. And this is also where you can bring an elemental, or not. Well, you could use an elemental like a spirit. I'm talking more of the elements, things like cold or starvation and things like that. These are very, and again, I'm going for like very hard to manage things in a tabletop game. But the things that end up being, you know, almost more harrowing than fighting a monster.
Sure. You need to have that underlying tension, the mystery, like who killed Laura.
Yep, exactly. So,
in Garfield, there's this story, and there's this great, like old, like 7 or 8 or 9 Garfield tales illustrated, and one of them is like this psychedelic world, and there's this glass box, and like if you look in the glass box, like all the mystery and the wonder of the world will be lost, and I won't tell you what happens. But anyways, yeah.
So I'm gonna take a page out of Matthew Coville's who's a DM YouTuber type of guy, dungeon mastering and game designer. You always have to make sure there's something older there because that's where the mystery is. So you can have like this mountain pass or something where this long forgotten city was, right? This long forgotten city.
That's funny.
Everyone's dead, and you start off with fighting these shades. You know these spirits of people that are so old and so hungry.
That's neat, dude. I want to say that like Graham Hancock in my copy of America Before Here, it's the Barnes and Noble exclusive edition. It's actually I would heavily encourage people to get that one.
Yeah, I just finished that book. Very good.
Very do you have it's very good that you finished it. Did you happen to have the Barnes and Noble edition then?
Not a digital for that one.
The reason I'm saying this, it says, if you can see this, I know the listener cannot, but there's some signatures on that page which read, "For Nathan Lee, stuff just keeps on getting older. Wishing you joy, Graham Hancock." It's very cool. And that's what it says. So when you say that there has to be something older there, you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yep, and that's
extremely circly come back around-y.
Yep, and that's just sort of like a general rule from Matt Coville, who really is a very good dungeon master.
There was a podcast or a web show about Dungeons and Dragons, and it had a really cool name. And I actually met one of the people. Maybe they were just a fan, but anyways, whatever.
Critical Role,
that's the one. Yeah. Cool, man. Glad you know that. So that's it. Seems like this has been like a synchronous, you know, ache of vault. I don't like that word, but like in the green language, it seems like it's been in the cards or the prophecy for a long time coming. So, providence, if you will. I know that in a few minutes, there's going to be a few very cool people that we're going to be sharing some very cool times with. So, I think we can actually start to simmer down now, as my grandpa used to say to his pet dogs, he would say, simmer down now, don't wake the baby, things like these. I really feel like, you know, it's like we're entering into some strange times. There's a lot of things that, you know, you can cherish that don't need to stick around. There's a lot of things that you cherish that should. And like things like that, I feel like don't wake the baby. Like that's something that warrants further discussion. But while we end up, why don't we figure out a quick idea for this upcoming Six of Wands? Because we can talk about this later, but I think we're going to have a really cool one happening this time. Last time we had some Men in Black there with like elemental guns. So why don't you say a little bit more about what's happening as this Oregonian trail team of four people starts to break down near the edge of this really old looking mystical super tall Douglas fir lines in cedar forest.
Yeah. So what I was kind of saying earlier, maybe you have a very much in America before thing, you have a civilization that was there so old that there's really no, you know, good visible remnant left of them, and then you have nothing left but a hungry ghost and shades, you know.
I like that. That's perfect. Let's start there. Yeah. All right, let's start there for now. Let's end the episode by starting there. Evan, thank you so much for coming on the Six of Swords. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man. I really I gotta say, you are a bright, futured, and gentle and really talented soul. And that's the end of the show.
End of the show, indeed, my friends. End of the show, indeed. As you look into the hollow of the noonday sun, remember the path is always above. Wait, sorry, I thought this was that... Oh, wrong meeting? Okay, holy crap, we're still doing the show? Oh, jeez, how embarrassing. Oh my god, we're doing this right now. All right, wait, is it done? It's over. You listened to it. It was good. You got it done? Holy crap. Okay. May everyone who's gotten this far have great kismet. I think you guys know what I mean. Have something fun happen after you've listened to this in the next 24 hours. And then do something nice for someone. And then do something nice for someone else. Don't just do something nice for someone else. Do two nice things. One for someone else and then one for another person. There you go. I don't know. What the hell do I know? And so many influences in this life. You know, you just really got to try to do your best and be there for other people. And sometimes I can be really much more pointed than I need to be. And I'm going to really work on using that Death Star force for even higher and better purposes, because I'm going to do that. That's I have the power. It's just what it is. So I'm learning to contour and refine and love even better than I have before. You know, just forgive people. Seriously, forgive people for their trespasses. Give away the stone. Let the waters kiss and transmutate these leaden grudges into gold.